From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
There are 746,000 reasons why there should be an independent counsel here, because that's the amount of dollars that John Ashcroft paid Karl Rove as a political consultant in the course of three campaigns.
John Conyers calls for an independent investigation into the blowing of the cover of an undercover CIA operative and tells Karl Rove in a letter to resign. A House committee votes to impose sanctions against Syria. And a peace group in Fresno learns in an unusual way that they have been under surveillance. One of the peace activists, or peace activists they thought were in their group, dies in a motorcycle accident. And when his picture and an obituary appear in the local paper, they say he has a different name and that he works for the Joint Terrorism Task Force of the Fresno Police Department. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. At least eight people have died after a car bomb exploded outside a police station in northeast Baghdad. Nearly 30 more have been injured. U.S. officials say a suicide bomber drove a white Oldsmobile through the gates and detonated a bomb that left a crater in the police courtyard 10 feet across and 4 feet deep. Meanwhile, the Spanish Foreign Ministry reports a Spanish diplomat was shot dead outside his home in Baghdad today. In other Iraq news, the U.S. announced they've detained 112 people in a major raid near the Syrian border in Iraq on Sunday. Among those captured was a high-ranking official in the former Republican Guard. On Capitol Hill, the House International Relations Committee voted 33-2 yesterday to impose sanctions against Syria. If the sanctions are signed into law, all U.S. exports to Syria will be barred except food and medicine. Travel by Syrian diplomats in the U.S. would be severely curtailed to Washington and within 25 miles of the United Nations. U.S. businesses would be barred from holding investments in Syria. Syrian-owned or controlled aircraft could no longer take off, land, or fly in the United States. Syrian assets in the United States would also be frozen. The sanctions are expected to be approved by Congress and the White House. The Washington Post reports the White House is launching a new public relations campaign to justify the invasion and occupation of Iraq. As part of the effort, President Bush is scheduled to speak today about Iraq, and Vice President Cheney will speak tomorrow. The Republican National Committee also sent out a briefing to reporters in an attempt to spin findings of Weapons Inspector David Kaye, who last week reported he found no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. The Republican briefing asked, what did David Kaye find? Hidden labs, documents and equipment, biological and chemical weapon catalysts, UAV and missile programs, and more, unquote. And National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice again justified the invasion as she spoke before the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations yesterday. She said, quote, Saddam Hussein lied to the Security Council and let there be no mistake right up until the end. Saddam Hussein continued to harbor ambitions to threaten the world with weapons of mass destruction and to hide his illegal weapons program. Israel has announced plans to mobilize over 1,500 reserve troops in order to increase Israel's presence in the West Bank and Gaza. The BBC is reporting the Catholic Church is coming under criticism for telling people in countries stricken by AIDS not to use condoms because they have tiny holes in them through which the HIV virus can pass. The president of the Vatican's Pontifical Council for the Family told a forthcoming BBC special, quote, "The AIDS virus is roughly 450 times smaller than the spermatozoan. The spermatozoan can easily pass through the net that is formed by the condom." In Kenya, where 20% of the population has AIDS, the Kenyan archbishop said, quote, "AIDS has grown so fast because of the availability of condoms." The World Health Organization has condemned the Vatican's views. The WHO said, quote, "These incorrect statements about condoms and HIV are dangerous when we're facing a global pandemic, which has already killed more than 20 million people and currently affects at least 42 million. The church has long opposed any kind of contraception because it claims it breaks the link between sex and procreation. The Boston Globe is reporting the White House may invoke executive privilege to bar the Justice Department from viewing some documents related to the investigation into who within the administration revealed the identity of the CIA operative to reporters. The White House counsel is reviewing all the documents pertaining to the case before anything is given to the Justice Department, which will then carry out the investigation. Attorney General John Ashcroft has rejected calls for an independent counsel. Senator Edward Kennedy of Massachusetts said, quote, "Asserting executive privilege would make a farce of the investigation. That's why we need a special prosecutor so that we can challenge any cover-up." Meanwhile, Democratic Congressman John Conyers of Michigan called on Bush advisor Karl Rove to resign over the CIA scandal. We'll talk to him in a few minutes. Republican legislators have announced they reached a tentative agreement to redraw the congressional districts in order to help more Republicans get elected to Congress. The final redistricting plan is expected to be unveiled this morning. Twice this year, Democratic legislators boycotted the Texas legislature and fled the state to protest the redistricting. In Ramallah, aides to Yasser Arafat are denying reports that the Palestinian leader is recovering from a mild heart attack. In Afghanistan, the BBC reports up to 80 people have died in the heaviest fighting the country has seen in months. The fighting's between two feuding warlords in northern Afghanistan. California Governor-elect Arnold Schwarzenegger announced plans yesterday to set up a transition team and begin examining ways to improve California's financial situation. The Washington Post reports Schwarzenegger offered few details on his economic policy, though he announced he will call President Bush and ask, quote, for a lot of favors. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Bush administration has announced that it will not be handing over the documents requested by the Justice Department out of as part of its investigation into who outed the covert secret CIA operative, the wife of Joseph Wilson. Press Secretary Scott McClellan said the White House may need up to 2 weeks to vet the material before handing it over to the Justice Department investigators. This comes as the House Judiciary Committee's top Democrat is calling on President Bush's chief political advisor, Karl Rove, to resign. Congressmember John Conyers wrote a letter to Rove yesterday calling on him to step down. He also said the Bush administration is engaged in what he calls a, quote, orchestrated campaign to smear and intimidate truth-telling critics. Last night, Conyers took to the floor of the U.S. House to publicly demand Rove's resignation.
Even if he hasn't broken the letter of the law, Mr. Rove's actions are morally indefensible. He has used his influence to smear and intimidate a whistleblower, an ambassador to the United States government, and to further publicize Mrs. Wilson's name, in fact, a CIA covert operative, and to impugn the Wilson's integrity. As a matter of fact, according to the New York Times, a Republican congressional staffer said the administration's strategy for dealing with the Wilsons was to slime and defend. There is a clear conflict when one is investigating the White House staff. And as a matter of fact, it has been reported in Time magazine that Attorney General Ashcroft, over the years, has paid Mr. Rove $746,000 for campaign consulting in his political races. It's also been reported that Mr. Rove was the driving force behind Ashcroft's nomination as Attorney General. How the religious right pushed for Ashcroft's nomination, written in the New York Times January 7, 2001, by David Johnston and Neil Lewis. We also know that Mr. Rove was reportedly fired from the campaign of President George H.W. Bush over a leak to Robert Novak. Why Are These Men Laughing?, published in Esquire magazine, written by Ron Suskind, January 2003. Wayne Slater, a Karl Rove biographer, notes a pattern of unethical behavior. He says, I don't know who leaked what to whom. Most people don't know the facts here. And both Bob Novak and Karl Rove have said it didn't happen. But I have to say that it certainly was consistent with the Karl Rove that I know. If he didn't do this, he certainly has a pattern of activity over the 15 years, 20 years that I've known him when he has done similar things. See CNN, October 1, 2003. Another Rove biographer, James Moore, thinks that he must have known about the leak and says, after having watched Mr. Rove for all of these years, I know full well, and anybody who knows the way he works, that something of this nature does not happen without Carl checking the yes box. I'm saying that if Mr. Rove is not involved, I'll eat the paperback copy of my own book, because this is a guy who controls everything, and he has a history of putting a layer of protection between himself and other people, using other operatives to get things done. Buchanan and Press, MSNBC, October the 1st, 2003. And finally, let us not forget that many have received information that Mr. Rove is the source of the initial illegal leaks themselves. According to the London newspaper The Guardian on October 1, several journalists have confirmed off the record that Mr. Rove is the source of these leaks. We know from The Washington Post that fully six journalists were called with the initial leak. Now, the above information is all publicly available. I do not possess a team of investigators. All one needs to do is gather this information is read the New York Times, Newsweek, The Washington Post, Time magazine.
Congressman John Conyers speaking on the floor of the House last night. Just before he went to the floor, I talked about with him his letter to Karl Rove, telling Rove to resign.
This is reprehensible. I mean, we now have identified the mischief as coming out of the White House. See, what has happened now that's different from the usual accusations that fly around here is that it has now been pinpointed to have come out of the White House. So when the president says, in effect, I doubt if we'll ever be able to find out who did it, that gives away the whole thing, because first, he's not good at finding people out of the White House or in the White House. Secondly, we all know that it came out of the White House because six reporters who got hustled by the White House said so, including Novak.
Right now, we have a situation at the White House where the deadline was set for the White House to turn over any information, any relevant information, to the Justice Department 5 o'clock on Tuesday, yet that was not done. What do you say about that?
Well, I don't know where they're going to get it from, the clerks and receptionists and secretaries in the White House. The people that were doing this are right there near and around the Oval Office. Karl Rove is not a guy that you have to wait for him to send in a document by Tuesday at 5 o'clock or something like that. This is the political director for the President of the United States of America. And so we have now, over and above the criminal aspects of this, which could earn anybody found guilty under 18 United States Code Section 793 of either promoting this or instigating this misinformation and revelation of the identity of a covert Central Intelligence Agency operative, you can get up to 10 years in a federal prison not of your choice. So,
Congressman Conyers, can you tell us what exactly you're calling for?
Well, I'm calling for, first, for Rove to step down, because regardless of the criminal character of this, the whole thing is obscene, and it seems to be clearly going back to him because some of the reporters said so. Now, number two, we are calling for an independent counsel to think that, which is precisely what the independent counsel was created by law, and we've had this for quite a number of years, or it created that when the White House or someone in it is under investigation, they will not have the investigation compromised by the person that the president named to be attorney general conducting, in effect, the investigation. Here, that's pretty patent. But in addition to it, there are 746,000 reasons why there should be an independent counsel here, because that's the amount of dollars that John Ashcroft paid Karl Rove as a political consultant in the course of three campaigns.
How often do you call for the resignation of an administration official, Congressman Conyers?
I can't remember ever having done it. I've called for some impeachments in the course of my career, but not resignations.
Has the White House responded?
No.
Have other Congress members or senators backed your call?
Yes, I'm running into people now that are meeting me and getting ready to do their own thing. I didn't consult with my colleagues when I did this.
Why at this point did you decide to do it?
Because I just got enough material together. I mean, look, this wasn't the toughest research I've ever pulled. A reading of Newsweek and Time magazine, or even one of them, should get you, should alert somebody without having to be a congressman or a lawyer or a member of the Judiciary Committee.
Congressman Conyers, it's interesting what's happening at the White House, because the press secretary has been saying, well, this investigation is the Justice Department's, all things should be referred to the Justice Department. Yet when the Justice Department tells the White House they should gather all relevant information and hand it in at Tuesday at 5, The White House then says they will spend the next 2 weeks vetting that information. Yet the press secretary had said right up through Condoleezza Rice that all relevant information should be given directly to the Justice Department.
Well, you know, one of the problems with tracking the contradictions and misstatements of this administration is that after you do so many every day, you get kind of numb to it. You stop. You can't be shocked anymore. I mean, how many times does this happen? And you can't say, I can't believe this, but it's happening. And the incredibly bold thing about this administration is that they do these things right out front. I mean, General Ashcroft says, look, we got to wiretap lawyers who have suspicious clients. That's all there is to it. And we reserve the right to take an American citizen and put him before a special trial with military people, executed if that's what they think is appropriate. We're fighting terrorism. Don't you folks get the problem here? So it goes on and on and on. Then he stops using the Patriot Act. A lot of people are exercised about the Patriot Act. But a lot of these things he's doing ex parte that are not even in the bill. And then, of course, they're drafting Patriot 2 at the same time that he's traveling the country persuading people that they would sleep more comfortably in their beds with Patriot 1. It's an incredible situation. And I have my responsibilities to bring it forward. There's one thing that will straighten this out is when the American people start rising up saying, this isn't partisanship. We want to have an investigation. If our CIA agents aren't safe because somebody in the White House wants to embarrass them, then what kind of a system do we have?
Last question. This was just called to my attention. The DNC chair, Terry McAuliffe, is calling on Congressman Sherwood Boehlert to postpone his planned fundraiser with Karl Rove that's going to be taking place in Cooperstown, New York on Friday until the Department of Justice probe into the outing of the undercover agent is completed. Any word on that or thoughts?
I didn't know anything about it. I'm astounded that Sherrod Brown and Karl Rove would be holding a fundraiser. Is Sherrod holding the fundraiser for Karl Rove's defense fund, or is Karl Rove holding the fundraiser for the re-election of Sherrod Brown?
Congressmember John Conyers speaking to us yesterday, just before he went to the floor of the House, calling for the resignation of Karl Rove. Again, the Boston Globe reporting the White House may invoke executive privilege to bar the Justice Department from viewing some documents related to the investigation of who in the White House blew the cover of a covert CIA operative. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll look at the possible imposing of sanctions against Syria. We'll go to Iraq to find out about the latest bombing and the protests that have been taking place there. And then to Fresno, California, where a peace group found out in a very sad way that they were being monitored. They picked up the paper, saw an obituary for who they thought was one of their members, but it said he worked for the police department in the terrorism unit. Stay with us. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Capitol Hill, the House International Relations Committee has voted 33-2 to impose sanctions against Syria. If the sanctions are signed into law, all U.S. exports to Syria would be barred except for food and medicine. Travel by Syrian diplomats in the U.S. would be severely curtailed to Washington and within 25 miles of the United Nations. U.S. businesses would be barred from holding investments in Syria. Syrian-owned or controlled aircraft could no longer take off, land, or fly in the United States. Syrian assets in the U.S. would also be frozen. The sanctions are expected to be approved by Congress and the White House. The vote came days after the White House expressed support for Israel's recent bombing of Syria. The attack on Sunday marked the first time Israel attacked Syria in 30 years. White House spokesperson Scott McClellan said yesterday, "We've repeatedly said Syria is on the wrong side of the war on terrorism and that Syria needs to stop harboring terrorists." Republican Ron Paul of Texas was one of the two legislators who voted against the sanctions. He said, quote, "It just looks like we're looking for more trouble." Republican Jeff Flake of Arizona also voted against the measure. The Arab League today criticized the bill, saying it would, quote, increase the tension in the region and make the chances for peace more remote. It also makes more difficult a dialogue between Syria as a main power broker in the region and the United States, the Arab League said. We turn first to John Bolton. John Bolton is the undersecretary for arms control and international security.
We've seen Syria take a series of hostile actions toward coalition forces in Iraq. Syria allowed military equipment to flow into Iraq on the eve of and during the war. Syria permitted volunteers to pass into Iraq to attack and kill our service members during the war and is still doing so. Syria continues to provide safe haven and political cover to Hezbollah in Lebanon, which has killed hundreds of Americans in the past. Statements from many of Syria's public officials during this time vilified the coalition's motives in seeking to overthrow Saddam Hussein. Indeed, the United States portrayed as an enemy is a consistent theme found in newspapers and public statements in Syria, as it is in other states in the region. Although Damascus has increased its cooperation regarding Iraq since the fall of the Iraqi regime, its behavior during Operation Iraqi Freedom underscores the importance of taking seriously reports and information on Syria's WMD capabilities. Now, on those capabilities on the nuclear side, we are concerned about Syria's nuclear R&D program and continue to watch for any sign of nuclear weapons activity or foreign assistance that could facilitate a Syrian nuclear weapons capability. We are aware of Syrian efforts to acquire dual-use technologies that could be applied to a nuclear weapons program.
That was John Bolton, Undersecretary for Arms Control and International Security, testifying before the House International Relations Committee. The House International Relations Committee has just voted 33-2 to impose sanctions against Syria. Now the House will have to vote, as expected, to pass that overwhelmingly. As we turn now to Patrick Seale, British journalist who's covered the Middle East for more than 30 years, author of the book Assad, The Struggle for the Middle East. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Patrick Seale.
Thank you very much.
Well, the U.S. Congress has just taken one step closer to imposing sanctions against Syria. What do you think will be the effects of this?
Well, this whole episode, it seems to me, demonstrates the vulnerability of the U.S. government to special interest groups. You see the pro-Israeli lobby and neocon officials, as well, of course, as Lebanese Maronite extremists, have been pushing this Syria Accountability Act for a long time now. Now, until now, the administration has been sensible enough to veto it and to say, look, this is not the right time. Syria is an important player in the region. We need Syria for the peace process. Now the administration divided with a nervous and experienced president is, I'm afraid, not opposing the act as it should.
Patrick Seale, what do you think has changed within the White House pushing now for these sanctions?
thing that's happened is, of course, the trouble the White House is in Iraq. The neocons who pushed for war against Iraq are now somewhat on the defensive. They didn't anticipate the chaos and the difficulty and the rising costs and the casualties. Now, some people think that they're also frightened that Bush will be thrown out of office next year, and this is their moment to complete their agenda, which involves weakening Syria and weakening Iran as potential threats or rivals to Israel.
The Undersecretary, John Bolton, has talked about chemical and biological weapons. How does it compare to what we heard the administration say about Iraq?
Well, John Bolton is, I'm afraid, a very discredited figure. He's always held these very fanatical views. He's never advanced any evidence for his allegations. This is the problem, that the administration contains people of his sort. It contains people like Paul Wolfowitz, who pushed for war and has been pushing for war against Iraq for the last decade. It includes people like Douglas Feith, like Elliot Abrams. All these are committed pro-Israeli officials who would want to do everything possible to weaken the countries who are opposed to Israel. Now, anybody who opposes Israeli aggressions is called a terrorist, which, of course, is utter nonsense.
If John Bolton is so discredited, he was the person last year who put forward that Cuba was developing biological weapons. Why are they using him to put forward this case? They're very vulnerable around the issue of lying right now, although the White House is just launching a new PR campaign around Iraq. Bush is speaking today. Cheney is speaking tomorrow. But why do you think they're using a vulnerable figure, if he is John Bolton, vulnerable to the kind of same criticism?
He has support among the neocons. As I say, the neocons have their backs to the wall now. Everyone is questioning their good faith. Everyone is questioning their honesty. Everyone is questioning the evidence on which they waged the war against Iraq. Now, this is the problem. Now, if we return now to the question of Syria, the suicide bombers, such as the young woman who blew herself up in Haifa a few days ago, have nothing whatsoever to do with Syria. She was driven to desperation by the oppression of her people. Her brother and her cousin were both killed by Israeli troops. Israeli troops would not let her father through a checkpoint to go to a hospital. He suffers from a liver complaint. So this girl went and blew herself up. Well, how did Ariel Sharon, Israel's prime minister, react? By bombing Syria. Now, obviously seeking a distraction from the failures of his policies at home.
Finally, Syria says it'll attack Israel if Israel attacks Syria again.
I don't think that Syria has said that, if I may correct you. One of their ambassadors, I think the ambassador in Spain, said something to that effect, that if there were numerous attacks in Syria, Syria would hit back. The government adopted a much calmer, soberer approach. President Bashar al-Assad has chosen a diplomatic and political response. He's gone to the Security Council. Now, one last word on this. The reason, in my view, that this Syria Accountability Act has now been revived and efforts are made to push it through the Congress are that Syria is on the point of signing an association agreement with the European Union. The European Union does not hold the same views about Syria that the United States government does. Now, the obvious strategy of the neocons is to try and undermine the relationship with Syria is developing with the European Union.
Well, Patrick Seal, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to be with us. Patrick Seal at Heathrow Airport in Britain right now, author of Assad, The Struggle for the Middle East. As we move now to the issue of Iraq, latest news, a bombing in Baghdad. At least 8 people have died after a car bomb exploded outside a police station in northeast Baghdad. And the Iraqi governing council fiercely objecting, and the biggest rift yet with the United States, to Turkish troops being sent into Iraq. I just spoke with Dan Murphy before the program, who is the reporter for the Christian Science Monitor in Baghdad.
The response of the Iraqi governing council, Turkish troops coming in, is sort of twofold. If you talk to almost anybody privately, or not even privately, they'll speak on the record, you know, they'll essentially say that we've all agreed to reject this. We are very uncomfortable with the Turks, or for that matter, any other of Iraq's neighbors sending troops to the country, because they feel that all of the neighbors have various interests in the country, and they're not trusted. You know, I think also that, you know, while it's maybe ancient history, you know, the fact that the Ottoman Empire, which was a Turkish empire, you know, controlled most of Iraq for long periods of time is also in many people's mind. That said, you know, the Americans desperately want to get any kind of help they can so that they can reduce their forces on the ground in Iraq, and have put, I think, an incredible amount of pressure on the governing council to withdraw a lot of its complaints, or at least play down this rhetoric of anger we've been hearing for the past 2 days. And so this afternoon, after a meeting between the council and senior coalition, U.S.-led coalition authorities, you know, the council put out a kind of sort of a not very strong press release that said they're still unhappy, but that they're working with the Americans to resolve the issue.
You've also, Dan Murphy, written about the mass protests that took place after the arrest of a sheikh. Can you talk about what's happened? How many people came out into the streets?
I think that if it was the sheikh in Sadr City a few days ago, I think, you know, I guess mass protest is in the eye of the beholder. You know, I think clearly a couple of thousand people were on the streets in that area, you know, at one point, you know, on the day in question. And I think it did underscore the fact that, you know, the Sadr City slums are where most of the poor Shias in Baghdad live, and no group of people perhaps are as happy to be rid of Saddam as they are, but they're also, you know, very impatient and unhappy with the U.S. occupation. And so, you know, we saw the other day, it doesn't take much to see very large outpourings of discontent and even anger at the U.S. presence here.
Can you talk about who the sheikh was, why it would anger people so much?
To be honest, I don't know a whole lot about him. And as a matter of fact, you know, there was a lot of confusing stories about whether or not he had been arrested by the Americans. I mean, what I can say is that he was alleged to have been in possession of grenades that he was keeping at his Hosseinia, you know, the Shia mosque in the neighborhood, which is why they originally took him into custody. You know, his supporters say, you know, he's only a man of God, and wouldn't possibly ever be involved in violence. And, you know, to the people that support him, they see him as you know, their chief intermediary to God and their chief explainer of the Quran. You know, and so figures like this particular sheikh get a tremendous amount of respect in Shia Islam.
What about the bombing today?
I think the bombing today is very interesting. While that was also in the Sadr City slum, interestingly enough, while we don't know who's responsible yet, I think it's clear that it's part of an emerging pattern of targeting of the local police who are working with the coalition, you know, because they're softer targets than an American soldier at Bradley in body armor. And, you know, to the very large numbers of Iraqis that are incredibly angry at the U.S. presence, you know, they see these folks as collaborators and a convenient way to strike out.
Finally, the overall unrest over the last days in Baghdad, Basra, Baiji, who is behind them? Who's out in the streets?
Well, I think this gets back to the question of, you know, this the bombing of the police station and the problems. I don't think that there's any one centralized group of people behind these things. You know, this thing this morning was a suicide bombing. I think it's very unlikely that, a Ba'athist loyalist or someone who misses Saddam Hussein would blow himself up for that cause. That was almost certainly, in terms of ideology, a religiously motivated attack. You know, in Beji the other day, which is an oil refining city, I think it was quite clearly, if not Fedayeen, some well-armed young men that I think it is fair to call Ba'athist loyalists. And here in Baghdad the other day, where we had these ex-soldiers protesting, while the coalition said that there was, Ba'athist loyalists stirring up these crowds, and I don't necessarily doubt that. If you went and met these people, they didn't take a lot of stirring up, and most of them, weren't loyalists to anybody in particular at all. They were just very, very angry. So the picture I'm trying to paint here is one of a number of different interest groups for a number of different reasons that are angry at the occupation, and as a consequence, are acting out.
Dan Murphy speaking to us from Baghdad by satellite phone. He works for the Christian Science Monitor. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
The thunder rolls through the plain, but there goes that little bird still. She's winging her way through the rain. The buzzard stirs in the gloom. The jackal stalked through the shade, but steering the dim edge of doom, the dove makes her way unafraid.
There she goes, on through the day.
There goes that little bird,
there goes that little bird,
winging her way, winging her way. Over the dove,
over the dove,
way up on high. There is a rainbow,
there is a rainbow,
spanning the sky,
spanning the sky. Over the dove,
way up on high,
there is a rainbow.
Pete Seeger here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, members of the organization Peace Fresno were recently shocked when they found out one of their participants, Aaron Stokes, died in a motorcycle accident. An obituary published in the local newspaper in late August showed Aaron's picture. But the name under the picture was not Aaron Stokes. It was Aaron Kilner, an undercover detective who was working for the Fresno County Sheriff's Department, also a member of the local anti-terrorism unit, said he died off duty in a motorcycle accident. A Peace Fresno member, Nicholas DeGraff, says, quote, "The first question on everyone's mind was a dove in hawk's clothing or a hawk in dove's clothing?" In other words, was he going to peace groups on his off-duty time or was he on duty monitoring Peace Fresno, that you were being monitored? Who first saw the obituary of, well, we'll call him Aaron, in the paper?
His picture, and asked if people could identify it, and the group overwhelmingly said, well, that's Aaron Stokes. And it's at that time that they clued us into what they had found out in the article you mentioned.
And so what did you do?
Well, at first it took everyone just a minute to deal with the shock. There was a wide multitude of reactions, from being angry that this would be going on, to being hurt, to others being fearful. After we spoke about it a while, we asked Catherine Campbell to send a letter to Sheriff Pierce asking him to clearly state, if Deputy Kilner was there on, say, company time, or if he was there, doing for his own purposes.
Catherine Campbell, you're an attorney. Is this illegal, what the department is doing, investigating the police department, monitoring Peace Fresno?
They seem to feel that it's legal. But there is California law that's been in effect since 1975 that says it's violative of the California Constitution for the police to infiltrate, for example, in that case, it was student groups, and to lie to them and misrepresent who they were and, in effect, act in an undercover capacity in order to monitor their activities. So there's a conflict on that issue. It is my opinion that it's illegal under California law. Actually, community groups, including Peace Fresno, have been working for about a year to get the Fresno City Police Department, the Fresno City Attorney's Office, and county law enforcement to tell us whether they were going to follow California law or whether they were going to surveil and infiltrate community organizations. They've refused to do that, but now we know the answer.
So what can people do?
Well, Nicholas has some, Peace Fresno has developed some responses that they plan to act upon, and I know that a lawsuit is a possibility. The ACLU in San Francisco, which has supported progressive community organizations in Fresno for about a year in their attempts to discuss the Patriot Act and government overreaching and this particular issue of surveillance, has expressed an interest in assisting us in a lawsuit. And I know Peace Fresno has some plans.
What are your plans?
Well, we're considering a few different plans at the moment. Some of the ones that are sort of popping to the surface at the moment are actually training a team of individuals to go around and educate community groups in the Fresno area about these types of issues, as well as what to do if they find out they have been infiltrated, such as the case of Peace Fresno. They're also looking into going back and meeting again with elected officials to try to use this incident as an example of why they really do need to work with us to write protections for civil liberties into agreements between local law enforcement and federal law enforcement. And just for the community as a whole, we're also looking at organizing a Know Your Rights educational forum.
What was Aaron Stokes, or I guess Aaron Kilner's, behavior in the meetings? What was his role, and which protest did he go with you on?
Most of his attendance was at the meeting. He wasn't disruptive. He was actually, I would say, a quite quiet member, which in our group is sort of sets you aside as being in a distinction. But he was just quiet and attentive, mostly attended meetings. However, he did travel with us to the protest of the WTO ministerial in Sacramento just recently.
Was he taking notes?
Yes, large quantities of notes and meetings. I didn't see him too much at the WTO ministerial, so I couldn't comment to that.
Does this change your feelings about new people coming in? Do you think that's what's intended to happen?
Well, I would say that whether it's intended or not, this, you know, that effect can happen if you have the law enforcement, you know, basically equating dissension to terrorism. This causes people to be less likely to step forward with their views and exercise their First Amendment rights. And people in Peace Fresno, we're trying to keep an open mind and not look at everyone as if they're a possible suspect. So in general, what we're trying to do is just keep things open and just make the community more aware of what their rights are.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Nicholas DeGraff with Peace Fresno and Aaron, was one of those who realized that their Peace member, Aaron Stokes, was in fact Aaron Kilner, an undercover detective working with the Fresno County Sheriff's Department, member of the local anti-terrorism unit. They only figured this out after he was killed in a motorcycle accident and his real name was put forward. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we move on to our last story today. On December 21st, 2002, 13 people were arrested for participating in a die-in at a military recruitment office in Ithaca. Four of the activists were minors, and their legal proceedings have garnered a special degree of support and attention. They defended themselves at their trial. This weekend, I had the opportunity to speak with two of them. Marie DeMott Grady was 17 at the time of the die-in, and Anna Flores Grady was 16. She talked about the trial and her action.
My name is Anna Grady Flores, and I was a part of an action on December 21st of 2002, along with my cousin Marie and 11 other people. There were 13 of us all together, and 4 of us were minors under 18. And we proceeded in a silent march through our local mall. There was about 300 of us there, and we were escorted out, and we went to another mall across the street, where we proceeded in a die-in at the in a military recruitment center. And we read a Martin Luther King Christmas sermon, one of his speeches, and we also read a depleted uranium fact sheet, which, yeah, I don't know. We were able to lay there. We lay there for about an hour and a half before they actually arrested us. We were charged with criminal trespass, a third degree, a misdemeanor. And since then, we've gone to trial, and so have our co-defendants. We were actually separated from the adults. I don't know whether you want to talk about that.
Yeah. So, my name is Marie DeMott Grady, and let's see. The 11 people, no, sorry, the 9 people who were not minors were tried on the 6th of May, and but they were separated from us because they are not minors. They are eligible for a jury trial, and we're not. And so their charge was lowered so that the court did not have to give them a jury trial. But since we don't get one anyway, our charge stayed the same, so we're being charged with a higher charge than people who did exactly the same thing. And so they went to trial on May 6th and were found guilty of... It was a violation. And so then we went to trial 3 weeks ago, and we still are awaiting the verdict, but we all just explained to the judge why we would take part in such an action, and explained to him why our action was legal under international law. And we had a woman named Cynthia Bannis, who was in Iraq during before our invasion and during the invasion and afterwards. So we had her come and speak and tell the judge about what her experience was, as well as John Shushart, who knows a whole lot. He's a lawyer and he knows a lot about international law, so he was an expert witness at our trial. And so I hope that the judge is able to listen to the laws that we brought into the court there, and go by them, and which, you know, those laws are supposed to be the higher laws. So we're just hoping that he'll, you know, go along with them and not the other ones. So.
Can you talk about why you decided to defend yourself and what you said?
Actually, the 4 of us decided that we wanted to represent ourselves, and we wanted to just let them know that we're not just young, you know, feeble little girls that they're dealing with. They're actually dealing with, you know, 4 strong women that are, we took these actions and we want to defend ourselves, and we want to explain to the judge that we want to tell them our story. And we decided if we had a lawyer representing ourselves, we wouldn't be able to talk to him and tell our story like we wanted to. So we had a lawyer, her name was Joni Brandon, and she was actually Marie's lawyer, but she guided all 4 of us. We wrote our own motions, and in the court we did defend ourselves. We did our own direct examination, and we didn't do cross-examination, but and we all spoke about our reasoning and why we were there, why we took such actions, why we thought it was legal, and why we thought it was necessary. And
Can you talk about what you said, why you thought it was necessary, what you were protesting?
My reasoning for why I thought it was necessary was, well, before I testified, my cousin Una testified, and the judge, the district attorney, our prosecutor, was basically saying to her, you know, your action wasn't necessary. It didn't make any difference. You know, you could have stayed outside of the recruitment center and it would have been the same. And she was saying, no, it wouldn't have been the same because we wouldn't be here today and all these 85 people who are behind us witnessing this whole trial wouldn't be learning this information, wouldn't know about this action. And so by us being arrested and actually going through with whole trial, that's why it was worth and necessary. So it kind of annoyed me that he was saying that he was trying to play our action down. And so the district attorney is African American. His name is Javon Garrett. And being half Guatemalan, half Irish, I felt that I had the right and the need to talk about the civil rights movement and how those actions were necessary. And so my cousin Una asked me why I thought it was necessary. And so I directed the question to Mr. Garrett, and I said to him, wouldn't you say yourself, Mr. Garrett, that Mr. Rosa Parks' action was necessary for your benefit and for mine? And he was very mad, and he stood up, and he's like, objection, Your Honor, I don't want a history lesson, and please, you know, tell the defendant to focus her answer. And I ignored that, and I said, I'll bring it back to Mr. Rosa Parks and say how her action has... I benefited from her action, and I know all the minorities who live in this country today have benefited from those actions that were considered illegal at the time, and now we're thankful that those actions were taken. And so I think the action that we took on December 21st was very much necessary for all the people in this world, U.S. and Iraqi.
Anna Flores Grady and Marie Dugmot Grady, they were 16 and 17 at the time of their action in December. You are listening to Democracy Now!, and that does it for the program. I look forward to seeing listeners and viewers in Austin. Austin Public Access Television has just started broadcasting us daily. We welcome you to the Democracy Now! Family. And also, that's Austin Convention Center on Saturday at noon. And then Democracy Now! Heads to Tucson. I'll be speaking at the Centennial Hall of University of Arizona on Sunday night, reception at 6:30 and a speech at 8 o'clock. So I look forward to seeing listeners and viewers there of Access Tucson and KXCI Radio in Tucson. We'll be broadcasting there live on Tuesday. That does it for the show. Democracy Now!, you can get a copy of the show by calling 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359. Our website, democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, Lenina Nadal, Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill, Purvesh Sharma, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.